The Late Debate with Cullum O'Mungon on RTE Radio 1.
The purse strings are loosened, so who can breathe a sigh of relief and who is left gasping? Which coalition member should get the most author's credit for Budget 24? And does the opposition deserve a few royalties too? And is this a big budget win for renters, for landlords or for mortgage holders? We'll have all that and more on tonight's Late Debate. Joining us here tonight in Buswell's Hotel on Kildare Street, right across from Leinster House for this Budget Night special for the next hour, are Damien English, Fine Gael TD for Meath West and party spokesperson on finance, Donnacha O'Leary, Sinn Féin TD for Cork South Central and party spokesperson on social protection, Lisa Chambers, Fianna Fáil senator and leader of Seanad Éireann, Jed Nash, Labour TD for Louth and party spokesperson on finance, Dr Laura Bambrick, social policy officer with the Irish Congress of Trade Unions, and Sean Keyes, finance editor with The Currency. Now, we do want to hear from you too. Please do get in touch. You can text us on 51551, email us on latedebate@rte.ie or tweet to @latedebaterte. Now, before we get to the panel this evening, and indeed before even Michael McGrath began his speech at 1 o'clock today, RTE's Ellen Leonard asked people in Dunboyne what they were hoping to hear from the ministers today.
Well, we have to pay €50 a week for a bus going to college, and I know some students that I know go to different colleges and they get a student discount when we don't.
So laptops for students are very expensive, and all the work is online, so you can't, it's kind of unavoidable, you have to buy one, and then if something breaks or you need to buy office, it's like extra on top of it.
Just, it's really hard to actually make ends meet. Some people are just working like off their budget, like week to week. You were on the job seekers allowance last year, and then you're going back into education, and you get denied the Susie grant, for example. You've no money really at all.
Well, I'm just hoping for a change in the inflation of prices. Like, I just realised, when I go shopping, like, it's crazy expensive. You know, I used to go to Lidl and you get, you know, bread for, like, it'd be like €1 or something, but now it's almost like €3. Even if you go to, like, the likes of Dunn stores, they could be up to, like, €3.99. You know, it's crazy expensive. So I'm a teacher, and I'm currently living actually at home, and this is something that I wanted to mention as well. It's just the cost. Prices of buying houses and rent is crazy expensive. Like, I'm teaching students, I'm having to travel so far, I can't afford to move out and leave where I work because I can't save.
To be honest with you, probably the price of the chicken fillet rolls now in Spar.
How much are they going up?
I know in Mullahoda Village they're like €6.50.
Gee, and what
for a meal they'll like.
What would you like to see in this year's budget?
Why is it that time, isn't it? The budget. Oh, I'd love to see a bigger pension for old people. Remember, I'm 89. I'll be 90 next birthday. And I mightn't be around for too many budgets. And those who are over 80 and approaching 90 should get extra money, I believe. See? I heard about somebody who paid €7 yeah, for a pint the other day. It's unbelievable.
Right, that's the hopes and dreams bit on the streets of Dunboyne, as gathered by Ellen Leonard earlier. Now, I'm not sure we'll get to the inflationary impact on chicken fillet rolls over the course of the next hour, and we'll discuss some of the winners and losers in just a moment with the wider panel. But Sean Keyes, I want to go to you first. And the Fiscal Advisory Council issued their verdict on Budget 24 this evening, saying that it was likely to keep inflation higher for longer.
Yes, the Fiscal Advisory Council, they offer, I think of them as the view from Singapore. And Singapore is a country, it's not democratic, but it's run by these, you know, benevolent technocrats who sort of do the right thing. They don't worry about politics, they don't worry about coalitions and all sort of stuff. So IFAC is thinking about, okay, in the absence of all these demands on the finance minister, what should he be doing? So they have a bunch of concerns. With the thanks to the prodding of IFAC, we committed to a spending rule of 5% core spending growth, and we have jettisoned that for several years. Now with this latest budget, it seems like there's very little chance of that coming back anytime soon. The spending rule seems like it's dead. Secondly, I guess they worry that by spending too much now, they are at risk of overstimulating the economy. So if you put too much money into the economy, if there isn't enough slack to sort of to absorb all of that spending, you're going to get inflation. So they've estimated that this budget is going to push up inflation by between 0.2 and 0.4 of a percentage point. in the coming years. And just more generally, I think we know that the big takeaway from the budget is that we're saving some towards various rainy day funds, and also current spending is going up. Their big point is we should have saved more for the future. We should have spent less right now.
All right. But as you say, they are unelected technocrats who are there to advise the government, and government is there to take or leave that advice as they see fit. But IFAC saying you're a bit too flahoolock with the finances is politically not necessarily a bad thing if other people are accusing you of being a bit too mean.
I would have thought so, especially if you're a centre-right government. Your main competitor is on your left side. Your main competitor is will spend more than you. If you're getting into a sort of a bidding war with other political parties, it's good to for people to feel as though you are constrained, and there's only so much that there is to spend. And IFAC is helping the government get that message across, I suppose, even though it is independent.
All right. To come away from, I suppose, the macro picture, Laura Bambrick, and look at the micro picture, who is Mr. or Ms. main winner in Budget 24?
Well, I think looking at the budget through the eyes of workers and working families, there is a lot to commend this budget. There are flaws, and they are pricey flaws, but there's some really significant highlights. We've heard a lot about the increase in the minimum wage. So we're going to lift the wage floor now, the minimum an employer can pay his workers. It will benefit 1 in 14 workers by moving it up to $12.70 an hour. And what that will eventually do by 2026 is to end poverty pay in this economy. So that's a huge, does it go far enough, fast enough for us? No, but let's recognise it for what it is. There was also significant reductions in out-of-pocket costs for workers. So government can protect, secure and improve workers and individuals' living standards two-way, puts more money in your pocket, or reduce the amount of money that has to come out of this pocket. And we've seen big wins around childcare, around education costs, and around rent subsidies as well. The other one is pay-related job seekers moving very much to a European model. For a long time, trade unions have been pointed out, when we're in employment, we pay pay-related contributions, but when we lose our job, we fall off an income cliff. And that, as being mentioned today, was really a case in point when we seen those 650 workers in Tara Mines. And another big thing was reinstating child benefit for 18 year olds still in second level education, and the double child benefit, because our tax system does not recognise the cost of children on a worker. I, as somebody, pay the same amount of tax with no children as I do with one child, with two, with three, with more. So they're really good. But looking at the lowlights, that is that $1.3 billion tax package. We would share some with the Fiscal Advisory Council in saying not so much that we spent too much, but that we spent it the wrong way, that it was wrong to give it as it was regressive to give it, that it would have been better on services.
All right, Damien English, to you first on that. On the one hand, Michael McGrath is saying he doesn't call it a rainy day anymore, but future contingencies, public service spending, if they're in the event of some kind of a global shock, the likes of the pandemic or a downturn or the likes, on the one hand, billions being put into a fund to look after those kind of contingencies. On the other, tax cuts. Is there a contradiction in this budget?
There's not, because number one of the aim of this budget is to deal with the present, which is the people under major pressure with the cost of living measures. And that's why you have a massive social welfare package, a massive cost of living supports, and the major tax change of over $1 billion. That is to support people to get through times today that are difficult because bills are higher, inflation is driving the cost up for everybody, and you have to recognise there is a cost to going to work. And we're very strong from a female point of view that you have to reward work and always encourage people to work harder, to do more, to do the extra shift if it's needed, to support innovation. And if the tax take is too high, or that if you go beyond a certain wage or walloped and paying tax of over 50% too quick, that's a deterrent to work. So that's important.
Okay, well, just
and then number two, then, sorry, Colin, yeah, the second part, then the second aim, it was just as important, is budget is to protect the country for the future. And if you don't set aside resources today for the future, that they can deal with difficult times in the future, keep the capital expenditure where you want it to protect jobs in the future, that's key. And this budget achieves both of that. It deals with a lot of the pressure on families and people today, as well as protecting this country for the future. Because while we've got high employment now, and there's massive benefits from that, from taxes coming in from the businesses and from the jobs and so on, that won't be there if you don't protect it. And that means investing in infrastructure, investing in businesses, broadband, again, today, more money.
Sure, okay. Well, just on the work point and encouraging people to work, the working family payment threshold has gone up by €54 in order to, so that somebody who is on the minimum wage doesn't lose that. It only covers 35 hours. So if somebody wants to do overtime, is that factored in as well?
It generally is, and the family income supplement has been changed over the last couple of years, and I think the changes today would reflect that, and it is covered.
Sure, but I suppose the increase in the minimum wage by 140, if the threshold is bumped up by €54, that covers 35 hours in the week.
In the social welfare bill, after you increase the minimum wage, everyone else is dealt with to cater for that too, because if you look at the effective rate, people are paying taxes and so on now, you have to make adjustments there to make sure that the minimum wage doesn't leave you, that you get to take home the majority of that change, which you will see, and that's key. But bear in mind, if you're on minimum wage today, and Laura's right, a lot of work's been done over the last couple of years. We committed to moving the minimum wage to a living wage over 3 or 4 years. That we have to recognise that is a massive achievement for the country, a small country going to achieve that. It's the right thing to do, but it also brings increased costs for business, and it'll reduce the margins of many businesses as well. Okay. So they have to also support business, which we're doing as well.
Jed Nash, you were critical of the decision to cut universal social charge, but Damien English saying there it's about striking a balance between people struggling in the here and now and the long-term objectives.
I was more critical if you dig a little deeper down to what I said about tax, about the changes made around income tax, because they do disproportionately benefit higher earners. There's a strong argument always to adjust USC bans, to adjust PRSI as well, in the event that the minimum wage goes up to a certain point, because what you want to do is, when you increase the minimum wage, what you want to do is ensure that the levels of increase are taken home by the lowest paid workers in our economy, and that's very important. And we established that principle actually back in 2015 when I set up the Low Pay Commission, and we've had a series of minimum wage increases since. Actually, what we should be doing when we're looking at how the personal tax system is considered is take a more modern, progressive, contemporary European approach. There are many EU countries we like to compare ourselves against, who decide routinely, it's in law as I understand it in some states, simply what you do every summer is you set out what's required to properly index social welfare rates, you set out what's required to index income tax bans and credits. Regardless of the rate of inflation. Well, you marry that, you assess that based on, for example, wage inflation and other measurements as well, to ensure that that's embedded in the system. I think that would be an illustration of a mature democracy and a mature governance system if we did that. And then on budget day, stop talking, doing the leaks, as far back as June or May, playing with people's lives, essentially. People often on very low incomes and people who may be dependent on the state for their income. Settle that question and then deal with the big political and budgetary questions on budget day, as most modern, contemporary European democracies we like to compare.
All right. Yeah. Lisa Chambers, what's wrong with that as a suggestion in terms of indexing core social welfare rates and the likes of the minimum wage in line with inflation?
I don't think Jed's fully explained what he's proposing as such or who we're being compared to, because he didn't mention any direct comparisons, but I'll deal with the points made around taxation. As a country, as our wages increase across the board, it makes sense for our tax bands to adjust to cater for that. And in relation to USC, the lower rate at which you enter the 4%, that amount was raised specifically to make sure that the increase in minimum wage wasn't caught by that. So if we didn't touch the tax packages, we would have actually undone some of the good work that was done around the increase in minimum wage and acknowledging the fact that we have a lot of inflation in the country and people do need a little bit of money back. But the tax package, while it was substantial at $1.3 billion, there was a $1.1 billion social welfare package, a huge amount of money spent on housing, $5 billion on housing. And Damien already mentioned the two funds, the Future Ireland Fund and the Infrastructure, Climate and Nature Fund. And I think credit to the government on that. That's the thing that I'm most proud of today. Those two particular funds have been set up, because when this all settles, they're the two funds that people won't really talk about. It won't be noticed. There's nothing back in the pocket next year. There's no votes in it. And we won't see the benefits of that for the next 10, 15, 20 years. So for a government of the day that could have spent that money today for the benefits of election in the future, as governments are often accused of doing, they didn't do that. And in 20 years' time, we will look back on today and the fact that those two funds will be put on a statutory footing. So any future government that wants to dip into that fund and doesn't allow it to grow will have to explain in Dáil Éireann and put it to a vote and explain themselves. And for me, today, that's the proudest thing I see today, is the establishment of those two funds, because it's protecting the children of today and the workers of today to make sure that with an ageing population and a growing population, okay, we have pensions, healthcare and home care for future generations.
Donnchadh O'Leary, your party accused the government of lacking ambition in this particular budget. Could you see yourself dipping into those funds if you were to win power in a coming election?
Like, I mean, I think the point has been made by Lisa that, you know, people would have been looking for to spend this and to build it into the base. Certainly that's not what Sinn Féin would have been called for. I can't speak for other opposition parties, but we're very clear that taxation streams that can't be relied upon, that are up and down and so on, you can't build them into the base. They're not going to be relied on in terms of...
So you agree in principle with the setting up of these funds? And
I don't have a particular issue with that, no. I think where the issue in relation to ambition is, like, I mean, look, if you... You know, people were talking about the chicken fillet rule, but in reality, if you talk to people on the street, one of the two biggest issues that are facing Irish society is the housing crisis and is the situation in our hospitals and our healthcare system. And in both of those areas, I think this budget has seriously fallen short of expectations or even what the government put out themselves in advance. Minister Donnelly announced 1,500 beds two or three times during the year, and it didn't come to fruition. The capital budget for housing next year is the same as it was last year.
Isn't there a common problem across both issues, though? You could announce all the funding you want in the area of health, but unless you have the people to staff the hospitals and man those beds, that's just an announcement of money. And similarly in construction, you can promise a spend, but unless you have the trade, the craftspeople to build the houses, the money is notional.
Okay, well, there's a couple of things about that. The first thing I do think that unites them is that, you know, while there are elements of this budget that I think are logical and make sense, there are other issues that I would have serious issue with. The fundamental issue with those two things is that there is no long-term strategic vision in relation to them. These are the core challenges that we're facing and we're not addressing them. Look, I mean, I think that in relation to staff and all that kind of stuff, yes, there are challenges, but there are also, I believe, resources being put into the wrong place. An awful lot of the budget that's happening there in relation to housing is in subsidising the private rented sector. An awful lot of what is being built is not necessarily what we need in terms of hotels and apart hotels and all that kind of stuff. There are incentives that can be created and what we've put forward in terms of in terms of stamp duty to try and reallocate some of those resources to building housing. They are the key issues that we are facing as a society, and I don't believe that the government has grasped that in this budget. Right. And I think when all is said and done, and yes, we can talk about the funds, and I'm not necessarily opposed to them,
sure,
but the legacy of this budget and the legacy of this government is in housing and health. Right. And to
point,
yeah, a couple of points. Just to be absolutely clear, the capital spend on housing next year goes up by over 10% compared to this year to next year. The overall capital commitment is over $7 billion through the different initiatives we have in play, along with subsidising and working with the private sector to deliver housing as well. Two things I will say. There is a long-term housing plan, and that has brought us from practically...
Not one that's succeeding, Damien.
Just practically only 7 years ago, the delivery of housing was less than 5,000 a year. Now it's at 30,000, we'll go above that. The long-term housing commitments, which we have set aside the money for the next number of years, so it's not year to year, we've actually set aside multi-annual funding for capital for housing, which guarantees that you'll bring it now from 30,000 up to 32, to 34, to 35. And you need to keep it at that for a long number of years to permanently end future housing crisis, as well as stepping in today through schemes like HAP, which Sinn Féin claim they're against, but yet they don't take them out of their budget. They make sure we keep HAP because 50,000 families at least are in HAP.
Can I clarify that?
And to be clear,
Sinn
Féin understands the fact that obviously on, you know, there will be a need to assist people with their rent. And we have never said... One sec now, Damien.
Don't interrupt now.
What's very clear,
our issue is
the absolute enormous reliance on private subsidisation. Of course, there would always be a need for subsidy. The fact is that is how this government and the previous government have effectively been betting the house on to try and resolve the housing crisis and not investing enough in capital and in building the social and affordable housing we need.
But Donoghue, your own alternative budget for housing actually pledged to spend less than what this government has pledged in this budget. Less spending. There's a 200 million euro gap in your funding as well, because the estimates from your alternative housing budget estimate that it cost 267,000 to build a home, and we now know it's 303,000. So there's actually a shortfall in what you're setting aside to build those homes that you're promising.
That assumes
to spend.
That all homes are three beds, semi-keys, as opposed to a combination.
All right, okay. I'll let you back in a moment.
Doesn't like me to make the points that holes in their alternative budget. They also, if they were in government today, they would scrap the Croí Cónaithe scheme, which is there to target vacant and derelict properties. They would scrap the First Home Equity scheme, and they would scrap the Help to Buy scheme. Be honest with people, what are you proposing? Because you're there poking holes in our housing policy, but you've yet to outline in anything you've said this evening what would Sinn Féin do in housing, because I don't see any plan.
Okay, Donal O'Leary, and then I want to go back to Jed now.
In terms of Croí Cónaithe, the refurbishment grant, we would reconfigure that. We believe that it needs to be directed to the local authorities, and some of the red tape that exists and some of the bad value for money that exists in relation to it needs to be limited. But we recognise the need for a housing refurbishment fund. Some of the other measures, including in reports commissioned by your government, recognises that Help to Buy simply drives up the price of houses. Mazar's report is saying to ye, that ye commissioned, is saying to ye that ye should end it by the end of the year.
You want to take 30,000 off people that are buying their first home.
What we want to do is bring the price of housing down. And any government that is not serious about that is simply adding fuel to the fire.
I'll come back to both the people from the government parties. I just want to go to Jed Nash on this. On the housing issue in this budget, what was your analysis of?
Well, I think they're asking the wrong questions. If you think that landlord tax reliefs are the answer, then we really do have a problem. We're actually spending more on our landlord tax reliefs that there's no evidence whatsoever suggesting that a relief of that nature will actually retain.
How would you keep small landlords in the market then?
There's a huge over-reliance on small landlords.
I know, but
that's the problem.
Would you concede that they're needed for the moment, and how would you keep them in?
Yeah, they are. I mean, they are private operators working in business themselves. There's no justification whatsoever for a landlord paying less tax than a PAYE worker. This is their business. That's their income. The treatment of their income should be exactly the same. So we're asking...
They pay more than corporate landlords.
They do. And, well, there's an argument, a clear argument for rebalancing of that. That's not the discussion we're having here today. We have rent tax relief for renters. We argue that it should be up to €1,000, going up to 750. That's fair enough. But more will be spent on a relief, in fact, that is not robust, that doesn't really pass muster, and I don't think will succeed in what it is pretending.
Sure, but do you have a proposal to keep small landlords in the market?
No, we don't. We don't, because our focus
you're happy
very
to see
much
them
is
leave
on.
The market,
like, for
right?
example, if you look at Croí Cónaithe, okay, this is Dara O'Brien's landmark scheme to get apartments moving around the country, especially in the cities. Conditions should be attached to that in terms of rental properties, cost rental. That's not the case at the moment. Spending a huge amount of taxpayers' money getting these developments over the line, for what purpose? Now, we know that obviously it has proven not to be effective. And I agree actually with Help to Buy. All of the evidence shows, in fact, officials in the Department of Finance themselves have been arguing with successive ministers that this has a dead weight effect. So in other words, it is promoting and encouraging activity that would already there's no doubt about it. Help to Buy is very popular and people certainly like to have 30 or 40,000 euros.
Damien, on that specific point, Donal O'Leary raised the Mazars report, and Jed Nash is talking about officials in the Department of Finance raising concerns about the Help to Buy scheme. Right. What's your answer to that specifically?
Because I was one of the ministers there that were brought in the first place in 2016. Why was it brought in? Because that starter home, that three-bed house, at a price range that young people could afford to purchase was not being built because they could not manage to get a mortgage. The Help to Buy was brought in. It gives them their own tax back, up to €30,000 people can avail of. 42,000 people have now...
Right, so it was to help people, to create the demand to provide the incentive to make sure that the
house and the price of the house went up 30 grand.
No, let me finish a point, Colin. So, because that came in, the supply of housing has increased.
All right. Briefly and specifically,
every incentive we brought in around housing is to increase additional supply. The only way you can solve housing and bring the costs of rent, which are too high, back down, is to fix and address and increase the supply.
Sure, but would you also concede not only is the the supply going up, the price has gone up, right, and people are getting help from family members where they're in a position to do so, to buy those houses on top of those schemes you're talking about?
In some cases they do, in many cases they don't, because you meet people who avail of these.
All right. I
make them one final point, please, on housing, because you let Donegh make a few points there. If anybody wants to compare the target set out by this government over the last few years compared to what Sinn Féin claimed they were building housing, they'd realise that our targets and our delivery are actually higher than what theirs.
Sean Keyes.
Just be clear on that.
No, you're missing that.
Sean Keyes, what do you make of the housing measures that are contained in the budget? All right, without interruption, Sean hasn't been in a while, we're going to go to Laura.
I find it a little frustrating sometimes that there is, at this time every year, there's a big debate about the housing budget and how big it should be and should it be bigger. And it goes from 3 to 5 to 7. But the total amount of sort of capital investment we need in housing every year in this country is around 20 billion. If you on the assumption of, like, say, a 50,000 homes needed and reasonable assumption of what they cost. So that's 20 billion is the number we need. But we're all debating the finer points of the government's end of it. And I think if the excessive focus on the size of the government's housing capital budget misses, like, okay, wait a second, what about the other 17 or 15? Why isn't that working? Why are we not getting it? What do we have to do to make that flow through the system correctly?
And do you believe there's any clear answer out there?
Influences the market.
Oh, well, that's a very big question. But yeah, I mean, there's a clear problem. I think, okay, firstly, it's the planning system is a very serious problem. I think, just very, very quickly, it's a very quick question. My little 2 pence is that Ireland and the UK have a very weird planning system. We should never lose sight of that. We look to the UK for leadership and guidance. We don't look to the places where they have actually functioning housing systems in Europe or in Asia. Their systems are completely and fundamentally different to ours. If we're looking at reforming our planning system, we should look at reforming it fundamentally and look at being inspired by places where it works in Europe or in Asia.
All right. Laura Bambrick, just on the housing. Do you think this budget edges the government any closer to getting where the public needs it to be in terms of the supply and the cost of housing?
Too big of a question for me, but just looking at the relief that has been provided for renters, that's a really important one for workers that are on modest incomes, but they're earning too much to be eligible for the HAP payments and maybe too much to be eligible for social housing, even if the capacity is there, and not enough to be able to get on the housing ladder. Really important. But then to put it beside by side with the relief that came today for landlords for all the points that Jed has made there. There's no evidence basis to say that.
Keep them
in there. To then give tax relief on passive income at more favourably than somebody that has to go out and earn it is an absolute disgrace. We had to strip that out of our income tax code and now we're going to do it. And it's just regressive on so many levels. So the good work they did for the renter has been stripped by what they're doing for the landlord.
Lisa Chambers, you want to respond to that specifically?
I do. Can I first of all say the tax relief for small landlords, and they are small landlords paying income tax, is a temporary measure in acknowledgement that small landlords are leaving the country. 86% of landlords own one or two properties. They're not the big corporate bad guys. Sinn Féin, Labour and others are vilifying landlords the last number of years to the point where they don't want to be landlords anymore. There's nothing wrong with being a landlord. That's a huge part of our rental sector. It's mom and pop landlords. Some of them are in negative equity. They're accidental landlords. They inherited the family home. They don't want to sell it. There's lots of reasons. If they do avail of this tax relief, which is up to 3,000 euros, it's not huge money. They have to keep the property.
How do you know that's the reason?
You'd know Fianna Fáil are back, wouldn't you? Landlord tax relief.
Look, Labour having cheap pops at Fianna Fáil is not going to arrest the decline in Labour support.
Just on that specific question, how do you know that's why they're leaving the market?
First of all, what I will say in that, if you want to avail of this, as the point I want to finish...
No, but just on that specific point, how do you know that's why they're leaving the market?
I'll come back to that. If you want to avail of the tax relief, you have to keep your property in the market for 4 years. If you leave in the next 4 years, the whole lot is clawed back. So there is a condition attached to it. How do we know they're leaving? The Landlords Association will tell us they're leaving. We have statistics in the Department of Housing that tell us they're leaving. And anyone suggesting that they're not leaving the market is not being honest about it. Yeah, but also...
Is there a specific... specific piece of research that says that's why landlords...
I was reading today the Department of Finance, some of the notes around this, the research they've used, and the research would show that landlords who have left the market, about 45% say it's because of the taxation, and that very often they're taxed on a loss nearly, and secondly was the regulation, but the majority was blaming the tax system. And I would say in fairness, in the last number of years, a lot of new regulations come in, a lot of it is very positive and needed to protect tenants and landlords, but that has come at extra cost. So the tax and regulation has made it more difficult for the landlord that we always had in this country, not the big investor, which I do think is needed at the right price, but the price is too high at the moment, but the other traditional landlord that did help us with our housing supply over all the years, they are leaving rapidly because they don't see it as viable. And this is to try to encourage them to stay, not to rush out of the market. If they want to go long term when we have other solutions in place, that's fine. But this is a worthy measure to try to stop that drain out and where we are losing accommodation.
Donal O'Leary, is there... I know your housing spokesperson has said before that landlords who want to leave the market should be let go and the state should step in and pick up the property when they leave. But in the short term, do you think that there is a case to be made to keep small private landlords in the market when they are, you know, the owners of the home and maybe accidental landlords and some of the circumstances that we've heard about over the last couple of years?
The first thing I say is just like, I mean, I've had landlords in the past and I've been perfectly decent to me. Actually, I've never had a bad landlord myself, and I regularly meet constituents of mine and they might have a notice to quit, but they say, look, you know, they need the property back and I have a good relationship with them. I don't have a problem with landlords. They have a role to play. There's no question about that. Does that justify this incredible waste of money that could cost 100 to 115 million? No, absolutely not. One sec. Like, first of all, for those who aren't thinking of leaving, they're getting free money. That's a huge proportion of them. For those who are thinking of leaving, are they going to be kept by 600 to 1,000 euro in a year? Are they going to be kept by that? I don't think they are in reality. I think that this is effectively a handout, and it's not the solution. And like, I mean, I don't know what document Damien was looking at earlier, but there was research done by the RTB, and it finds the biggest reason that landlords are leaving the market, and they are leaving the market, not in the scale that I think the governor put forward, they are leaving the market, but the biggest reason is not taxation. A lot of them, it's because their house is coming into positive equity, they bought it 25 years ago, they're coming to pensionable age, they want to cash in on that, and they're entitled to do that. It's not taxes, the reason. And even if it was, is 600 to 1,000 euro going to keep them there? It's not. It's free money. It's a waste.
Okay. All right. Look, we're going to go to a few texts from our listeners. The Vincent DePaul has texted in to say they welcome some of the measures, or many of the measures, in today's budget, but are disappointed that there weren't more and targeted at the core social protection payments and kept in line with inflation, and one-off payments are just that. They're temporary, says Nesson Vaughan, who's he's the chair for National Social Justice Committee of St. Vincent DePaul. Somebody else texting to say, really positive measure on increasing the Section 4881 tax credit cap. Seems a small measure, but will help attract international film and TV production. And then finally, Mark says, pensioners and the unemployed get a measly 12 euro a week. That won't cover food inflation. The 450 energy supplement is not enough. Most energy bills are over 200 for 2 months, and the government is afraid to get tough with the energy providers and large supermarket chains, says Mark. We're going to go to a break and come back with some of that after this.
Email latedebate at rte.ie.
Hello again, welcome back to the Budget Night Special, coming to you from Buswell's Hotel, right across from Leinster House, where the budget was announced earlier today. With me here are Dr. Laura Bambrick, Head of Social Policy and Employment Affairs at the Irish Congress of Trade Unions, Sean Keyes, Finance Editor with The Currency, and our political panel is Fianna Fáil, Lisa Chambers, who is the Seanad leader, Sinn Féin's Donal O'Leary, their spokesperson on social protection, Fine Gael's Finance spokesperson Damien English, and Labour's Finance spokesperson Jed Nash. To you first, Sean Keyes, on the social protection measures that were referenced just before the break. The difference between, you know, the 12 euro on the core rates and the 27 euros that's been called for, it would seem that to keep things in line with inflation, there's an argument to be made to boost the core social welfare rates. The government is dealing with this in one-off measures. Is there a right course to steer on this, do you think?
I think they are mindful of not having spending accounted for as core spending and therefore being baked into future spending. But I mean, but that's sort of they choose to categorize it this way now. But like in reality, is this spending likely to be sticky? Is it likely to stick around in future years? And that's the question if you're wondering about the sort of fiscal sustainability of the budget and so on. And so a lot of these one-off measures, like those you described, yes, they're categorized as one-off measures, but I'm not certain how one-off they actually are, and may wonder, will they be just a permanent part of our spending going forward?
All right. Laura Bambrick, do you think people will come to it when it comes close to Christmas? People who are perhaps struggling on social welfare payments might be hoping against all hope that a double payment will come every Christmas and across a number of rates in order to alleviate some of the strains they're under.
Well, we do have the Christmas bonus, so that's an established part of our welfare system for it. And a lot of these payments are going to be front loaded from the end of the year and towards Christmas. I think it's when people come into the new year that it's going to be difficult. So the 12 euro that's going, if the forecast of where inflation will be, that will be enough, but it's not enough to make up for the lost ground since inflation returned in 2021. And you ask, what can we do? Well, we already have a government commitment when we look at the state pension, and that was to peg increases in the state pension to either cost increases in wage or inflation, price inflation, whichever is higher. And as Jed mentioned there earlier, that is the way every other rich European modern country does it.
Did Congress put a number on the increase in core social welfare rates?
Yeah, we supported the advocacy groups that were looking for that 25 euro increase, that were looking to make up for the lost ground, because poverty hurts us all, whether you're working or whether you're not. Workers, they get sick, they have babies, they go out on paternity leave, they retire. So it's really important that we have a strong social welfare net for those times when you have gaps in unemployment. So our welfare system is a worker issue as well. It's not just for those that are very distant from the labour market.
All right. So Damien English, where did the 12 euro figure come from?
Well, again, I mean, inflation has come down quite a good bit in the last few months and was predicted to come down again more and extra as well. So the 12 euro, I think, is a reasonable amount in line with our core expenditure. And This country suffered badly. I mean, we discussed how...
Do you know where it came from, though, as a figure?
Can I finish the point?
But I know, but that was the question.
I can imagine Heather Humphreys in banging the table with Michael McGrath and Pascal and everyone trying to achieve the best possible. But you also have to try to do that within budget. So I think there's clever use of the increased corporation taxes this year to manage the once-off payments, which are considerable amounts, and there's a number of them before Christmas as well, and they'll really help get people through a difficult time. But we have to remember, when we talk about future-proofing this country and setting aside money for investment in services and infrastructure, but also in future pensions and so on, we're just about recovered now, I would say, as a country, from the mistakes made before, where our core expenditure, where we used once-off taxes or bonus taxes in core expenditure across many areas. And the pain that everybody went through, all these pensioners, everybody else. The finishing point went through great pain because they got unsustainable increases and it had to be taken back off them. We're not letting that happen again. So while people might say 12 euros is not enough, and we could all argue it wouldn't be great if it was 15, 20, we all would like that. But the reality of it is, you'd end up giving it this year and taking it back in 2 years' time, which is no good to anybody. It has to be sustainable and fair. And I think the right balance is achieved here. And that's not easy politically, but it's important that we do protect the country and protect those pensioners and their incomes, not yo-yo payments, you know, in terms of their core payments.
Although the reduction in USC is a core payment that you're committed to, and it's not a one-off.
No, it's permanent, yeah.
The USC is a permanent because, but again, sure. The USC cut of a half a percent. It's not a 3% cut because that wouldn't be sustainable.
So why, Lisa Chambers, do you think a different standard applies that one-off payments are given to help people, as Damien English said there, to help them through the hard times? But 1 in 7 children are in poverty. I mean, it's always a hard time for people in that position. Why are they less deserving than people who are getting a reduction on the 4.5% USC rate to 4%?
Well, they're not, and we're not pitting one citizen off the other. And child poverty is something that, you know, we've made some progress on, and there's a child poverty unit that's been established in the Department of...
But are you, is that not what a budget is? It's a zero-sum game. Some people get, some people don't. And in the case of this, the people arguing on behalf of higher social welfare increases are looking at the 12 euro increase and saying it's not enough to keep pace with inflation. People who are getting the USC reduction are getting that.
Yeah, so on one side you have IFAC saying we've gone too far, and on the other side you've got the opposition saying we haven't gone far enough. This budget was delivered in the context of really high inflation, and I suppose advice to government that if they do too much, they could stoke inflation. So that was tempering what could be done in terms of putting money back into the economy. So that's why there wasn't the levels of increase that we would have loved to have seen. But I think it's still a significant increase across social welfare payments and the minimum wage going up as well. But the one-off payments, the reason that they're there is because we can use the windfall tax receipts to fund one-off payments because it's not permanent expenditure. So we know why that's been done. And that's because inflation is so high at the minute. But as Jamie said, is going to come down. It's at 5.5% this year. It's due to come down to 2.5-3% next year. So we are trying to ride out that storm and get people over this winter, this Christmas and into next year. And of course, we will be looking at this again in next year's budget. But really, it was to make sure that we struck the right balance, not stoke inflation, but help people as best we could. And I think we struck the right balance.
Jed Nash, do you think they're really one-off payments, as Sean Keyes was saying there? They're sticky and things have been sticky since the pandemic.
Yeah, you know what's sticky as well? Inflation, especially grocery inflation, energy inflation. And we know that inflation is experienced by different socioeconomic groups very, very differently. We know who's most adversely affected. It's lone parents, it's rural dwellers, people living on their own who are on small and modest incomes. And one of the more disgraceful things today was the fact that the Taoiseach has not delivered on his commitment to start to end child poverty. One of the quickest and easiest ways of making a meaningful intervention on child poverty would be to increase the qualified child payment by, as the Labour Party proposed, 10 euro for children under 12 and 15 euros for children over 12.
All right, well,
just let me finish. That hasn't happened. The Taoiseach actually would have been better off. I said it myself in the chamber today. I was actually quite moved by his commitment in December that he was going to embark on a mission to eradicate child poverty. And there are some good measures here in the budget today.
Yeah, well, the increase in school books, not the hot to,
absolutely,
meals, four-year increase
really important,
in the
things
in the
that my own party have been campaigning for years. But one of the most meaningful things that he could have done if he was serious about this would be to make a meaningful difference, a sizable increase in the qualified child payment. Child poverty stays with you for your life. It's a scandal, the levels of child poverty we have in this country. And I'm now, unfortunately, in a position where I have to second-guess the Taoiseach's commitment on this.
All right.
Setting up units is all well and good.
I'll come back to you. I'll come back to you.
All well and good. Actually, what
put a figure on it there. What would you have increased core social welfare rates by?
We would have spent over 1.4 billion euro on bringing it up to the level that the measurement called the MESL, the basic level of existence, a dignified existence would suggest.
Right, so rather than bring 12 it up to that level, rates, what would you put on it?
Of course, we wouldn't either. €27.50. We've agreed that. And I'll tell you why. The last three budgets, the pension, for example, the purchasing power of pensioners has declined.
Okay, Donal Colliery.
Yeah, well, the first thing is, I mean, I think I agree with the point that has been made in relation to, to some extent, we need to take the politics, not the politics, no, I don't like that phrase, but I think we need to take the speculative politics out of maybe the social welfare budget. And I think what Sinn Féin has proposed and what we proposed to introduce in this budget was a social welfare adequacy commission, not dissimilar to the low pay commission, that would be able to take into account things like the MESL, which is, you know, the basic cost of your essential goods, things like inflation and so on, and that they would be able to recommend to government what is the appropriate level of increase so that you don't have this stuff about a fiver or a tenner every year, that you're dealing with it in a,
I know, there's a fiscal,
in a more scientific way. Yeah.
Would you commit to implementing the findings? Because there's a fiscal advisory commission that's supposed to advise on budgetary matters, and people can take or leave their advice. So if you form a social welfare commission, how long is it going to take, and would you be bound by its findings?
Look, well, I mean, we had the Commission of Tax and Welfare that essentially suggested taking the similar road, so it's there. The decision can be taken. And it takes is a political commitment.
Like, I mean, at the end of the day, politics
indexation,
is, you know, democracy is government decides. Like, I mean, and, you know, it will be in the gift of any government. But, like, I mean, I think there's clear weight and authority to the Low Pay Commission. And I think you would have similar from a Social Protection Adequacy Commission. The other thing I'd say is, like, I mean, when we talk about social protection, and social protection has a role in supporting us all as a society, but its most important role is protecting the most vulnerable. And in relation to child poverty, and I think particularly in low parents, we still haven't undone the damage that was done in terms of the crash. There are two cliff edges that affect low parents very significantly. At seven, that you lose the loan parents payment, you can no longer qualify for working family payment. That's a serious cliff edge. And again, at 14, it really negatively impacts. We were proposing to raise that from 7 to 12 and the higher cliff edge from 14 to 15. And that would have lifted, given an awful lot of more single parents the opportunity to work. The other is in relation to disability. There has to be recognition that there is an increased cost in disability. And that's why we proposed a higher increase for those on disability-related payments of €20 rather than the 12 that the government has brought in.
Just to go back on Jed's charge about towards the Taoiseach, what Leo committed on very clearly, and as a party, we very said we want to commit to the best start for every child. I understand that Vincent de Paul today welcomed the majority of the initiatives to say that the initiatives that were into this budget today go a long way to achieving that. And just to go through some of them.
Some do help, and
yeah,
I said that.
No, but they very clearly said, am I right in saying that? Yeah. Vincent de Paul came out very strongly saying this is a welcome move in the right direction.
They said they welcome many of the measures but are disappointed that they were not more targeted and that the core social welfare payments were not increased in line with the inflation.
But they said there was a progressive move to benefit every child here. Reducing childcare fees, investing in their education, foster care allowance going up, parents benefit.
Direct cash is important.
54 increase in the special family payment, increase in the qualified payments for children, a 2.3 social welfare budget which will impact every child in this country who needs that, who has that problem.
Personal tax, 1.3 billion on the social protection.
I want to get to another issue, which was mortgage interest relief. Sean Keyes, to you first on this. For a long time, it seemed that the government didn't favour this measure of providing interest relief to mortgage holders, and they didn't like it until they did. Do you know what changed, or do you have any insight? I'll get to the political panel on this. So do you have any insight into it, or any view of the advisability of the measure?
Well, I could guess what changed. I mean, the pressure was rising, interest rates were rising, percolating up in the market, constituents were calling up. It's a tricky measure though, because from my understanding, it applies to this year. In the following year, it doesn't apply if people who find themselves rolling off mortgages in 2024, they won't qualify for it, and it's just going to get messy. And I'm sure the government will then be revisiting it. So it's a messy program. And I guess the other point is just we should count our lucky stars that mortgage rates have risen as little as they have. Compared to the rest of Europe, just through the vagaries of the financial markets, we won't get into them here. But people,
I suppose, who are on tracker mortgages, who at a given point when interest rates were rising, were the envy, when they were low, they were the envy of everybody else. But over the last year and a half, in that Windows 10 rises, they've seen their monthly payments go up by around €400. I suppose they may not agree that that's low.
Yeah, I mean, it's okay. Sorry, I sound callous, but it's obviously €400, and it's coming after tax. It's a huge amount of money, and you can see why there was such clamour for relief and why it was granted. People don't have that amount of money that's over spare.
Yeah, I'll come to you in a minute, Damien English. Laura Bambrick, did you support the move on mortgage interest relief?
We expected it to be much more targeted, and we expected it to be targeted at those so-called mortgage prisoners that were in there for vulture funds. It's not clear from what was announced today that that's who it is. It's much wider than it is, as you mentioned yourself. It is for it will take in people who did benefit from that tracker mortgage and now are going to benefit from the fact that, you know, their product has went up as well as down. There are going to be lots of winners and losers in this, and the devil will be in the detail. Right. And I definitely think this is one that's going to come back to bite. And again, it's bringing things back into the tax system that we worked really hard to clean our tax system with.
But I think the expectation I think people's expectations can sometimes be beyond what we're able to meet.
Absolutely.
You know, and it is a challenging issue to deal with. There's an acknowledgement by government today that we've had 10 interest rate hikes in a relatively short.
But what changed? I mean, you were against it.
Pressure. I think there was a realization at government level that this was impacting people severely. There's lots of cost of living issues that are affecting households, but I think the message was delivered by probably constituency TDs across the country.
There's serious danger here.
Can I just finish the point I was making? That it's a fairly conservative relief. It's up to a maximum of €1,250 if you've seen an increase in your interest rate between 2022 and 2023. So it's not just those on trackers. It depends on when you fixed. So it will be in the detail as to who qualifies. And it's where you have an outstanding balance of 80,000 to 500,000. So if you have a much larger mortgage, you know, a more valuable property, you won't come into that bracket. So it is targeted.
It's very widely drawn.
But all it's always negative. It's always a challenge.
So Lisa Chambers, Damien English said it was in response to pressure. How did Sinn Féin manage to hear that pressure first?
No, I'm sorry, government TDs hearing the constituencies brought the message back.
But the people who brought it, the party that brought it to
the public.
But the party that made it a core proposal first, if I'm not mistaken, was Sinn Féin. The government was initially against.
Okay, Colin, but take into account that if you're a government TD or a government senator, you're not going to publish proposals. You go direct to your minister. So this issue has been raised by government TDs and senators long before.
What changed?
So if you check back all the finance question time for the last number of months, and I'd say it will be right back as far as the spring, Michael McGrath has consistently said that there's an issue there with people who are trapped. And Laura's right. The main aim of this was to try to reach those 7,000 to 8,000 mortgage owners who are in that space of not just 10% interest increases, but massive increases in many cases, and could be facing 7%, 8%, 9%. And he's always said that he would try to find a way to address this. He said that very clearly for 7 or 8 months, along with Pascal Donoghue as well. So just to be clear on that. So there's no big change in this. People think, because there's But again, this incentive here will probably affect and help about 120,000 mortgage owners. So it goes beyond the main aim. But to get to those who really need it, you very often have to have a little bit wider net. The finance bill will deal with this as well. But I think it's the right intervention to try to...
All right, hang on a second. Because I just want to go back, because in terms of putting this on the agenda, Sinn Féin has got a lot of the credit for it. But Donal O'Leary, it's been seen as part of Sinn Féin's political shift to the middle ground, that a large amount of expenditure was going to be allocated for people on tracker mortgages who had done well in the years of low interest rates, and it was an attempt to get votes of a cohort of people who hadn't traditionally been in Sinn Féin's voting base.
Well, the first thing I just want to say, I do think you're right to pose the question in relation to, I think it is Sinn Féin that put this on the agenda, and while I think that the execution left a bit to be desired, and I think there is that point that Jed has made in relation to people who refix next year, and a lot of the detail of it seems that it could be a bit messy, and it certainly could be better designed. The reality is that I think you need to have a heart of stone, people coming into you, talking to you about €500 increases. There isn't a household in Ireland, hardly, or certainly not an ordinary household in Ireland, could sustain that kind of level of increased expenditure. It just isn't sustainable.
Sure, but where were the cries of pity for people who were on variable rates during the low interest years, when people were paying very high interest rates and who were paying, you know, that figure above what people on tracker mortgages were paying?
Look, I think, you know, the extent and frequency of the increased rates that we've seen would not have been anticipated. And
so you bowed to the pressure from a vocal middle class group of people who had done well in the years of low interest.
I don't think that this is well off people by any manner of means. A lot of
I know, but a budget is a zero sum game, as we've just discussed in terms of the social welfare measures.
The alternative is that you say to these people, tough luck, and an awful lot of people fall further behind on their mortgages, potentially face repossession or other bills go unpaid. you know, things aren't bought for their children. People make decisions on what bills they pay and they don't pay. That's the alternative to supporting people who are down 400, 500, 600 euro. There are people who are down 600 sure. euro a month because yeah, of the increase. So I think people like that do need assistance. Right. An awful lot of them are very, one, very ordinary.
Okay, hang on a second. I want to get in. Jed Nash hasn't been in on this yet.
There's no doubt that, and you know, all of us are public representatives. We represent people in those situations. Dire situation. 50% of the inflation we're experiencing at the moment actually has been caused by increased interest, mortgage interest. We need to be conscious of that. It's not an especially social democratic intervention, and there are questions of equity around the use of state money in this regard. There's other obvious questions as well, and these questions have been raised with me all the time over the last few days, especially by people, for example, who did fix their mortgage or maybe coming off a fixed mortgage next year. The way this is drawn, it seems to me that they won't qualify for any benefit from this. That's something.
I just want to be clear.
And it's going to be really.
Okay, what side of this? You said there are questions around.
I've spoken to Dáil, as have, and I won't speak for them, but they have the same view because they've been saying the exact same things. There are questions about social equity, about the use of state resources in this way. Yes, there is an argument for providing some kind of supports. The best way, by the way, to support people who are most vulnerable in these situations, the mortgage prisoners that Laura referred to, is introducing a system, and Michael McGrath has spoken about this, Minister McGrath, and the Banking and Payments Federation, to allow people to move back to the pillar banks at reasonable terms and conditions, reasonable interest rates. And what I'd propose, in fact, is that we should threaten the banks with a super levy, because the banks have responsibility here. They're the operations that actually sold these loans to funds. Funds are a loan to themselves, it seems, in this country to charge.
Would the bank just find a way to pass the cost of the super levy on
local authorities? Local authorities are back in the business now of mortgages. Local authorities as well could usefully, I think, be used to actually help to service those mortgages in a way that the funds never could. So that's a way of dealing with, I think, the more difficult cases.
That's our lot. That's all we have time for this evening. Sean Marram was our broadcast coordinator. Researchers by Ciarán Dunn, Aislinn Grofferty, Jamie Dáil and Damien Gavigan were on sound, and tonight's programme was produced by series producer Penny Hart here in Buswell's Hotel and Cora Ennis back at base. Up here next on RT Radio 1, it's Cathal Murray with Late Date.
The Late Debate on RTE Radio 1. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player app.
Colm, thank you very much, and good night to you and the Late Debate team.
Late Date with Cathal Murray on RTE Radio 1.
Hello there, hope you're doing well, and you're very welcome to Tuesday's programme. This is The Verve.
Change, Jack.